the conflict of interest register, if there is anything under that that needs to be changed, you could advise Kay. Is there anybody that considers they have any conflict overall or for specific matters today? Or think that anyone else on the board may have such conflicts? Thank you. The confirmation of the minutes from the 19th of March, they have been circulated. Are there any corrections? Thank you. They may be confirmed. The next item is the action item list. There's a couple of verbal updates. Justine.
Sorry, John, we need a mover for the minutes.
Sorry?
We need a mover and a seconder.
Oh, well, I'll move the minutes. Is there a seconder?
I'll have it a second. Barry here.
Thanks, Barry. And everyone's agreed. Justine, do you want to do the health hub, the treasury rules? It's probably in the circumstances, nothing's, and we wouldn't expect anything to have happened over the last 3 or 4 weeks, given what's been going on.
Yeah, effectively, there's been no movement on that from Treasury.
Well, I think rather than, we will list it, but only when we've got through this and you have something that you can advise us on, we can simply reactivate it. So we'll just hold it there as an item.
Sure.
Both equity and primary are going to be reports to the May meeting. The next item is a recommendation appointing James and Catherine to QFARC and hospital advisory in one case and hospital advisory and public health in the other. I know of your commitments to the City Council, but I did some research, and as I understand it, board members have always taken up their role on committees in the past. So I'm moving in terms of recommendation 2. Is there a seconder for that?
Yep, absolutely fine by me.
Thank you, Jamie. Is there anyone who wants to speak on this item? All those in favour?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. We will then go to Justine, the terms of reference review.
Yep, so happy to take the report as read. Essentially, what we've done is attached the track changes for the draft amended terms of reference, mostly procedural changes more than anything else, and some tidy up of languaging.
Okay, Andy, you're the chair of that, so do you want to speak to this and perhaps move the terms of reference?
No, I don't think I have anything to add, not dissimilar to the changes that have recently been approved on our other committees. So I'm happy to move it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do I have a seconder?
I'm happy to second Barry here.
Yeah. Barry, are there any questions, comments from anybody? All those in favour say aye.
Aye.
That's aye. Loud enough, I guess. Thank you, and that's approved. Thank you for that, Justine. The oral update, I'll be very brief. We've been through some amazing times since our last meeting, and David, you and your team have gone through yet another extraordinary time and have addressed all the issues and problems put in front of you in a way, in a professional way we've come to expect. So I would just like to congratulate you on that. And would pass on to the whole organisation, because it's just not those at the top, it's the whole organisation that keeps it ticking along in these circumstances. I think it would be proper to note with sadness the outcome of C19 getting into the dementia ward at Rosewood and the consequences of that. It's very sad, and it's very sad that the circumstances prevent family members being able to be there to say an effective farewell. It's something you warned us about early on, David, that the worst case scenario was C19 getting into an ARC dementia ward, and sadly that's exactly what happened in Christchurch, and I'm sure you will comment on that. The other thing I just will comment on briefly is the TOW3/ compliance matters. I think we need to make an urgent decision on this today. I've expressed to the board and board only that I have a very real fear that we could lose this funding if we don't act quickly. And that is something I don't think the board, whatever option is favoured, that's something the board can possibly afford to risk. So other than congratulating you and your team, David, for the sterling work that's gone on in very trying times, and thanking you on behalf of the community, I'll just hand over to you for your update.
I'll just give a very quick overview, and happy to take any questions. I've asked Alan Pithy to join us, and he'll join in probably the next 4 or 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Just to give a bit of a conversation around PPE, which has dominated a lot of conversations from one end of the country to the other, and a lot of it reads me poorly informed. And Alan, in terms of our infectious disease expert and chief ex-chief of medicine, has led a lot of the work that has happened around our response. And a number of you may recall that he was instrumental in the suspect Ebola case that we had here a number of years ago. In terms of knowledge and understanding about PPE and suitability of that. But I thought that was probably appropriate to spend, or to get Alan to talk to the board around that, purely and simply given the extent of noise and comments sitting around that. There has been, again, considerable comment over the, what I might start off with, first of all, John, as you touched on, just acknowledging those that have, the 6 residents that have passed away with Rosewood. Again, a very complex and vulnerable part of our community in terms of high-end psychogeriatric patients. And all with, well, most of them with underlying health and complex health conditions. The care that has been provided to the individuals has been exemplary. And at some point, it will be good to get the on-site clinical leader to perhaps brief the board actually what it has been like within there. And the we've also had captured some of the snippets of the feedback from the families, which has just been absolutely, absolutely stunning. And most of the families have been able to be connected through the use of technology in one form or other to be there and you know, with the both the care of their loved ones and also the passing of a number of individuals when that has occurred. I will go into a bit more detail later on just about a number of choices and decisions and timelines, which I think important for the board to understand, and working on the basis of what you read in the media is not always actually correct on a whole range of different fronts. And I'll give the board a bit of an insight of that a wee bit later on, which may help put a bit of context for that. Now, I've seen that Alan has joined, and just before getting Alan to just talk us through PPE and the responses around that, it is worth noting that this morning there are 23 COVID possible patients within Christchurch Hospital. That just gives you a wee bit of a sense with the case definition. All patients that meet the case definition are treated as COVID positive until it is deemed otherwise. And the reason for highlighting that is just given the extent of the flow and the disruption that sits within areas like Christchurch Hospital. I'd also just like to acknowledge the work from, and you touched on that, John, across the whole system, whether that be community and public health, with the contract tracing, right through to the Christchurch Hospital. It has been fantastic, the response that has sat within there, and also with mental health services, which has gone a wee bit under the radar screen, but that has been really, really fantastic to date. The primary and community response with the CBACs and also our site redevelopment and maintenance and engineering teams that have worked to get those facilities set up as appropriate. The work that's actually gone on with the aged care sector has again been really extensive over a long period of time. And while we've got two aged care clusters, to put it to context, it's two out of about 102 facilities that we have in Canterbury. And again, I'll touch on that kind of a wee bit later. It's also been, and I've missed out a whole lot of other teams, but it's been interesting too in terms of the separation of teams and working in remote environments for many. Has certainly been a both a new, challenging, exciting opportunity for many teams. But I will just leave that there at the moment. And Alan.
Good morning.
Good morning, Alan, and welcome.
Thank you. Where would you like me to start?
Well, we're understanding you're going to give us a run through on PPE and some of the myths that are appearing in the media and such like, so the board can better understand it.
Okay. So, so personal protective equipment, PPE. I think the first thing to say about it is it's only part of the solution for protecting both our patients and our staff, and it's really important to understand that. That there's a whole pile of other things which are part of it. And then the second thing that's important to say at the very beginning is that the PPE is only as good as how it's used. And that's the other critical thing. Because there is a lot of conjecture and misinformation about PPE and around whether one form is better than another. Often there's actually no scientific evidence to say that one is better than another. For instance, around the masks, the N95 mask versus the surgical mask. So there's a lot of, when there's a lot of emotion, it's very easy to see it's emotion. You just have to look at the international newspapers any day and it's very easy to see that. And then just one other thing about it is that the PPE is not a limitless supply. So we have tried to approach it in as much of an evidence-based way as we can. And we have tended to follow the guidance of the Infection Control Committee here, and particularly Josh Freeman, who is the acting CD of Infection Control. He's given a lot of thought to it, and we're following pretty much the way that the WHO recommend it. One of the issues, I suppose, is that different jurisdictions around the world have different interpretations, and we tended to follow both the Ministry of Health and the WHO are pretty much aligned. So as a consequence, and then lastly, just another preamble about the whole thing, is you have to understand the local epidemiology to understand the way to use PPE as well. So we aren't Milan, and we aren't New York, and we aren't London, nor are we Wuhan. And so that takes into account much of what is recommended around, for instance, the use of standard surgical masks in the clinical environment. So, for a patient with, for the patients at Burwood who are known to have COVID, and that is a particularly a high risk area, we have a number of patients out there, and they're all very, very sick individuals, and they require considerable nursing care to be fed, to have their medications, and all those things. That's probably one of the higher risk situations, and a lot of work has gone into working with the nursing staff out there to ensure that they are using appropriate PPE and understand how to use it, and particularly how to take it off and things like that. Much of the debate has been around things like, are their gowns the correct gowns? Are their masks the right gowns? Shoes and hair wear and eye protection. What they've been using has actually been what is considered as the standard, a WHO standard, and there's never been a study to suggest that, in fact, anything is better than that. In fact, most studies, Cochrane reviews, haven't demonstrated anything is different. Having said all of that, we have tweaked that a little bit. We tweaked it yesterday, and we decided that because a number of the staff have become infected, and I can talk about that if you want, how we think that happened, we decided to go out and have a chat about, again, go over the donning and doffing, making sure everybody was very comfortable and knew and understood how to do it. And also to talk about whether N95 masks specifically would be the advantage of the surgical masks. And I did it. Actually, I went out yesterday at 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning, and spent a fair amount of time with the nurses talking to them about the use of masks. And we decided that whilst there was no hard evidence that the masks they were using were inferior to the N95, we decided to put that option in there. And I spent quite a bit of time, as I said, talking to them about how you fit these masks. They're a bit harder to fit and take off, for instance. And so we spent a bit of time ensuring if anybody wanted to do that, they could use those. We don't think there's an issue with the gowns. Oh, I'll go back a bit. I think actually the nurses on the floor there, actually, and certainly the ones I've spoken to, including the charge nurse and her deputy, are all comfortable with the equipment they're using. And if you talk to any of them who are actually on the floor there, they feel pretty comfortable about it. We think that the nurses unfortunately got infected, probably two of them at least, on the Monday when the patients were transferred from Rosewood. And we understand that that was a very difficult shift for everybody on the floor, that you've got to remember these patients are incredibly disabled and required full nursing. And it was a very hot environment. The nurses got quite sweaty, the equipment got damp, and there were definitely potential for some breaches. So we think it was rather a breach of the PPE rather than the fact that PPE was inadequate. Is that clear? The difference I'm explaining there?
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be some questions at the end, though, Alan. Yeah,
sure. Okay. So that we believe was the issue there, and again, what effort we've made when we went and talked to the nurses last weekend and again yesterday was to double up on ensuring that they were confident in the use of the equipment, they knew how to take it off correctly, and we have recommended that they do it with a buddy system, which is somebody watching them doing exactly what they're doing. Now, that's there. In Christchurch Hospital, what we've done is we've created, red zones, and there's a red zone in ED for potential COVID patients, and in the acute medical admitting area, the AMAU, and also in the intensive care unit. And what we've done is we've put specific recommendations on the use of PPE in all of these areas, and we have got a standard level of PPE, which again is consistent with WHO recommendations. For specific what we call aerosolizing procedures, then that is stepped up to use a different type of mask. And these aerosolizing procedures are only done in the in the negative pressure rooms that we have. So up till now, that's what's been happening. We have negative pressure rooms in our EMO. We have got a couple in the intensive care unit, and we have a couple in the gynae ward as well, which will be the overflow ward if we ever had enough cases to require that. Outside of those red areas, our recommendation to this point has been that there is no requirement for staff to wear surgical masks for direct patient interaction. Now, there's undoubtedly that's a debatable thing, but we believe that the epidemiology as it is here, meaning there's so few cases, doesn't justify the routine use of masks. And that in fact, there are serious concerns about just the use of masks, whether they're actually beneficial or not, because they're only part of the solution. And secondly, there's always been concerns about the supply as well. And when we first, actually about a month ago, we actually thought about making masks universally recommend them. And then that we were told we'd only have a week of supply. So we thought that wasn't a good idea because we would be using up all our supply at the time. Now, I understand, in fact, that things have improved since then, but there's still some issues about supply of masks and gowns and things. We certainly don't want to be in a situation like in London and elsewhere where there's a lack of PPE. So there's plenty of PPE around. We've been trying to use it appropriately. In Rosewood at the moment, the nurses there are all using full PPE just to care for the remaining patients there, although we haven't identified a single case of COVID in the remaining patients, but we still think it's a high-risk situation. I might stop there because I could probably go on about it for hours, to be honest, but it's probably...
Thank you. I'll see if we have some questions from board members. Joe?
Oh, sorry. just one quick, and I know this seems a ridiculous question, really. How long does that PPE gear, how long does it last?
That's a good question, actually, because you've all probably heard things like people in America keeping their mask on for a week and things. So what we recommend, what we think people, nurses and doctors should do is they should wear the same PPE for a clinical session. So a nurse would probably go through three sets of full PPE during one shift. So what would happen, I might as well talk you through this, I'll give you an idea of what's happening at Burwood. So they come in the separate entrance, they change into surgical scrubs. They then don their PPE in a clean area, and that consists of gown, gloves, mask, and goggles, or potentially a face shield. And then they enter the area, work with the patients, and after 2 hours, they will then go for a break. And when they go for a break, they'll take all the stuff off and dispose of it. They change the gloves between patients, but they'd only change the gowns and the masks if the mask got soggy, for instance, or if there was some kind of technical failure, or if they got soiled, you know. Came with patients, the gowns can get soiled, obviously. So in those circumstances, of course, they would change them. But otherwise, they would only change the gloves between patients, and they would take their PPE off and dispose of it. At the end of the 2 hours, they would go for they change just down into their scrubs, go and have a break, 15-minute break. During the break, there'd be only two of them, and they'd do their social distancing, ideally, and then the two would run back to the ward, and they would don clean set of PPE before they entered the ward again and go through that. So they'd on average use about three sets in a shift.
Sorry, and the second part of the question, long term, how long does the gear last? Can you stockpile gear for a long time, like 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? Does the gear last?
Oh, yes. Yes, you can. In fact, there have been studies done on N95 masks, for instance, to show that they remain effective in their filtering capacity many years after they have been produced. I did see a study, and it's just one study I read, which suggested that they only lost something like 1 or 2% of their filtering capacity over 10 years.
Okay, thank you.
So generally, they do remain effective, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Andrew?
Thank you. I wondered about...
Andy?
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Andrew.
Yep, thanks, Alan. I wondered about immunocompromised patients at Christchurch Hospital. And I guess I'm thinking of chemotherapy, radiotherapy, bone marrow, child cancer. I wondered about the nursing practices there, and I guess with radiotherapy, not so much nursing, but the medical radiation therapists.
Yep.
And the stuff they're wearing.
I can only give you some general things about that, to be honest. But what most of these have, all right, I'll start again. Some of these services have split into sort of red and green streams. Radiotherapy, for instance, has, and oncology has given thought to how they will stream patients who may or may not have COVID. So that's part of the issue. If we have an emergency admission to, let's say, oncology, and we've developed some pathways around what's the best flow for a patient. So, for instance, if you had a patient who had an oncological problem and it was deemed to be the major reason for hospital admission, but they might have minor COVID symptoms, they would go to the oncology ward to be put in the side room there, nursed by their normal nurses and tested. If it was somebody who presented with what looked like COVID pneumonia, then they would go to the down the AMOW stream and be looked after by the COVID medical team, but with support from the oncologists. Regarding, did you mean what's the risk from the staff, though? Is that what you're saying? What are the staff doing around PPE?
That's correct.
Yeah. So the staff are using PPE not routinely on the wards. It has been, and the reason for that decision was what I alluded to earlier, is that a lot of it was around the local epidemiology and the decision around the best use of what was thought initially to be a limited resource. And we didn't want to be in the position of consuming all our gowns and our masks too early, as has happened in many other countries, as you'll be aware of. Now the local epidemiology has flattened completely, and what we're seeing is only a handful of cases locally, and these cases are actually fairly predictable, i.e. they're coming from rest homes, they're still travel-related, they're cluster-related. So we think it's very unlikely that individuals will end up in the hospital and be undetected, so to speak. So we don't actually think, and also we think with the local, with the lockdown, staff obeying hopefully most of the social distancing at home and in their bubbles and things, we haven't recommended that staff wear PPE unless there is a respiratory type of presentation. So if you go to the oncology ward at the moment, the staff will not be wearing PPE unless they're dealing with a patient who has either respiratory symptoms or is considered as a possible COVID case. Does that answer your question?
It does, thank you. My second and last question was a broader one. And as we come out of level 4, and there's enormous pressure on government to do that, I wondered about the management going forward. And I'm conscious that a group of Auckland academics are promoting what's happening in Sweden and the more liberal approach. Well, I had a look at Sweden and they've had 119 deaths per million, which would equate in New Zealand on a per head of population basis to 583 deaths.
Yeah, absolutely. So
I didn't personally consider Sweden a model. It sounded more like genocide to me.
Yeah.
So I wondered about, as we liberalise and go forward, and that's a political decision, but I wondered about how we manage that as an organisation, really.
Yeah, okay, well, that's a really great question. And it's actually been something which has been exercising our minds a lot in the last few weeks, actually. And reassure you, I have a meeting this afternoon with oncology, general surgery, and we've got a working group. So we don't think it'll ever be business as usual, Andrew. What we do recognise is we have to get on and get people treated again. So we need to get people screened for bowel cancer, breast screening, everything else. We need to get people getting their heart scans done, all that sort of thing. But we do recognise that we can't go back to just the way it was, because that then could introduce the virus back into our systems. So I think what you'll find is that there's going to be, I can't tell you what the answer is going to be yet, but there's a working group exactly to look at this. How do we deliver oncology services in a safe way in the future, for instance? And it's going to be around things like screening of everybody before they come, streaming as well, perhaps working longer days, maybe more routine work over the weekend, so as you space everybody out, just in general, perhaps people will be asked to put a surgical mask on when they come to clinic. There'll be a lot more clinics done through teleconferencing and on the telephone. We'll have to try to space out the oncology day ward, you know, to make sure that people are 2 meters apart. All those things are a huge amount of work, actually, for the re-establishment of the services. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. Barry, anything?
None for me, John.
Catherine?
No, I've had my questions answered. Thank you.
Thanks. Jamie?
Sorry, just hitting the mute there. Just one. Thank you for that, Alan. Look, as we move down the COVID alert levels, is there any research or advice around members of the public using PPE, namely masks, you know, in levels 3 and below when they're in the supermarket or anything like that? Or just interested to hear your take on that.
Okay. There's no evidence that wearing a mask in public is of any value. That's the first thing. You might argue there might be in the tube train in New York or in London, but actually there's no real evidence for any of what's going on. Social distancing and avoiding large groupings is definitely makes a big difference. But actually, the evidence around wearing a mask in public just doesn't exist, and the WHO did consider this very recently and decided not to go that way. Some countries have. You need to again look at the basic epidemiology. New Zealand's had less than 1,500 cases in a country of 5 million people. Most of those cases were either related directly to travel initially, or they're now related to clusters, rest homes, weddings, etc. Community transmission is incredibly low, possibly less than 2%. So that means that there may be 30 cases in New Zealand, potentially, which could be community related. So the chance of you meeting somebody wandering around the supermarket with it is
very, very low.
So I know everybody's doing social distancing out on the pavement and things. We would consider that for the risk of transmission, broadly speaking, you need to have about 15 minutes of close contact with somebody face-to-face. That's the definition we use for close contact. There's no doubt that there are super spreaders. And clearly, there are people who are very, very infectious, and that's probably the background to some of these clusters you see, such as the Bluff wedding. So the broad answer is that there is probably no place for that here.
Thank you.
Sorry, I give you long answers sometimes.
It's a good answer.
Aaron?
Yeah, hi, Alan. Just got two quick questions. One is, yesterday we had 20 cases come through, 6 were confirmed, and 14 probable. The question that I keep getting asked is, why is there so many probables when they get a test, and is the testing not clear? What's the answer around the number of probable?
So there's several reasons, actually, as you might expect. So one of the ones is that if you have a cluster such as, and it's probably worth explaining this, if you've got a cluster such as at Rosewood in the ward there with the 20 very sick dementia level patients, they haven't all been tested, even when they show symptoms. And the reason for that is, if you've shown that 6 of 20 have got it and they've all got the same symptoms, there's actually practically not an awful lot of point in testing the others, because you can assume they've got it. You can make a reasonable assumption just on the basis of what we know about the dynamics of these infections. And then secondly, also, many of these patients who are very, very unwell, and they're incredibly unwell, these patients. It's actually unpleasant to have a nasopharyngeal swab done. And so the team who were looking after them deemed that they didn't need to do that. They were all going to get treated the same, essentially. They're all in the same isolation. They're all in their individual rooms, to be honest. So they've all been separated, but they're all being treated the same, whether they're confirmed or not. So that's one thing. And second thing is that sometimes the test itself is not foolproof. The test has probably got 70% sensitivity. It depends a lot on which point in the illness the test is done. That too early, it will be negative. Probably when people got lots of nasal and throat symptoms, yes, strongly likely to be positive. But actually, once somebody develops pneumonia, it then reverts to the nasopharyngeal swab. The nose swab is less sensitive, and then you have to look at sputum from the chest. So there's issues with the test. And then for many people, the staff, if you look at, for instance, the the rest home outbreaks, some of the staff have been tested positive and some have had symptoms but tested negative. But because they've had symptoms, they've been part of a cluster, then they're treated as probables.
Right.
So now, not all the probables, of course, will be true cases. You know, it is an overestimate. So, the 14 probables yesterday, I can't tell you how many of them are true, you know, but that's where it's all come from.
Yeah, so that leads me to my other question, and it's part of our way forward, is there's, yeah, obviously the media will speak to any epidemiologist in the world right now because they are the rock stars of the universe. And the thing going forward is antibody testing to kind of across the population to know who's actually had it, because some are saying this is 300 times more contagious than regular flu. A lot of people are going to get it, hardly even know they've got it. But then to build our picture going forward, can we mass test our population on blood testing, doing antibody testing? Is that accurate? And then we can build a picture for a possible, some of our, you know, solutions going forward.
Yeah, okay. So it's a complex question. Undoubtedly, first of all, there isn't an antibody test available yet. I mean, there are many being developed, but there isn't a reliable one being developed. And for an interesting discussion of this, Kim Hill was speaking to a virologist last Saturday from the UK who's actually developing one of the tests. And I can quote him in saying, there is not a reliable test yet. We're working on this. Any tests you buy at the moment are going to be unreliable and don't bother. So that was first thing. Antibody tests do show if people have had this infection in the past. Undoubtedly, there are large numbers of people who have been infected with this virus elsewhere who have shown fewer little or no symptoms. The only way that you can explain the differences in the mortality rates, if you compare the likes of Italy with Germany and here, is because Germany and here, we're picking up people who've got really minor symptoms. That's one of the ways, one of the explanations. So Italy's reporting something like 12% mortality. Germany's reporting about 1% mortality. And we're reporting way less than that. We've had 9 fatal cases in over 1,400 reported cases. So we're about 0.7 or something. So what I'm getting at here is that different countries have got different testing strategies. It's very likely in Italy, for instance, that they're only testing people who are very sick and in hospital, and they're missing huge numbers of people. And it's been estimated that 5 million Italians might be infected. And similarly in the UK, there have been various projections saying that in England and Wales, there might be as many as 1 million, or some people have said as many as 10 million people in England and Wales have had this infection. I think that's unlikely here, though, to be fair, because we're much later in getting involved in this epidemic. We shut our borders much earlier than the UK. For instance, the UK was still flying people in and out of Italy about 3 weeks ago. And our testing strategy is that we test just about all comers with even a trivial runny nose. And we are picking up very, very few. We're picking up only 1%, roughly, of the tests we're doing are positive at the moment. In the UK, it's 50% of the tests are positive. So for a whole pile of reasons, it's unlikely we have vast numbers of people who've been infected and will be antibody positive. Does that answer your question, or is it a bit too complicated? Sorry.
No, that makes complete sense. You look at Singapore as well, and they've had 5,000 cases, and their death rate's even lower than ours. So why, when so many people get infected, do they have such few death rates? And then other countries, it's just not making sense yet.
The other factor is the age group. You've got to remember that the mortality goes up dramatically in those over the age of 70. And so the mortality in those over 80 is actually around 20%. And even everybody describes that. if you look at our if you look at our age distribution, we've only got 100 patients over the age of 80. I think actually might only be 100 people over the age of 70, to be honest. I can check. But anyway, we have a relatively few older people. But we are seeing the same impact as seen all around the world, that once it's in a rest home, it is absolutely devastating. And you might have read some of the reports from overseas, you know, rest homes in the UK where 50% of the residents have died, the same in Canada, terrible outcomes in rest homes in France, Spain, Italy, etc. And in fact, the problem with underreporting of deaths from rest homes, because they're not being counted because they're not hospital deaths, and we're counting all our deaths here. We also look at everybody's been tested here as well, and that's not necessarily true elsewhere. But the fact is, we only have 1% of testing, which is positive. And that means there's a lot, 99% of people who are being tested are negative, which means we're doing a lot of testing for the population size we have, and we're not finding a lot of this infection.
Thank you. Gabriel?
I'm fine, thanks.
Naomi?
No, nothing from me.
Thanks. Ingrid?
No, nothing from me. Thanks very much, Alan.
Thank you.
So just a very brief question. Thanks very much, Ellen. When we start re-establishing services, I was thinking about elective surgery.
Yeah.
Are you in your working groups working to a specific protocol that would be specific to elective surgery as well?
Yes, we are. But I must tell you, we're just kicking off there. Okay. Yeah. And that's going to be one of the discussions this afternoon. But I've been talking to Greg Robertson, who's the Chief of Surgery and Aesthetics. We've had meetings with the private hospitals as well. We've already started to talk about how we can get elective surgery going again. And you should be able to definitely get going again within, but there will be some limitations initially at least.
And the protocols would be across public and private, the same protocol?
Broadly, yes. They'll have to follow the same rules, but yeah. I think broadly, yeah. And we did have a meeting a couple of weeks ago with all of the private hospitals, which I attended, and we just sat down, and that was more about how to deal with the acute problem at the moment, but we've already, as I alluded to, started to talking about recovery, because we realise there's a huge backlog of care needs to be delivered.
And just based on what you've said in some of your previous answers, it seems unlikely that a testing will form part of the pre-elective surgery screening at this point in time.
Oh, you mean a nasopharyngeal swab? I think personally that's not a good thing to do. I know that some people have suggested it, and in fact there are protocols saying it's good. The problem with it is that the incubation period of this illness is 14 days, up to 14 days, okay? That would mean that you'd have to test somebody potentially every day for 14 days to identify that person. Now, the average time is 5 or 6 days, but even if you tested the person who has an incubation period of 6 days, they're not going to be positive in day one and two. Yeah. So testing in that for an asymptomatic individual has very limited value, yeah. Really does. You're much better to risk stratify using clinical criteria.
Yeah, yeah. No, thanks very much. I found the whole session very helpful, actually. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Lester. Alan, thank you very, very much for that. I'm sure that's enlightened a lot of us, because there's a lot of misinformation out there with the media, as there often is. So thank
Could
you.
Could I say one other thing?
Yeah, sure.
So I'd just like to talk about the GG situation at Burwood. Because I've been out there a couple of times, and the nurses there are doing the most amazing job. I'm getting a bit emotional, actually, thinking about it. So the reports that they are delivering substandard care are inaccurate and, frankly, destructive. The nurses there are dedicated. They know what they're doing, and they're delivering amazing care to these patients. Also, they themselves on that ward feel confident in the main with the PPE that they're using. And I've talked to them now twice, and I intend to go out to talk to them again either this afternoon or tomorrow. But the report, when I went to talk to them, they were not exhibiting stress about it. Obviously, they were worried about their colleagues who got infected and wanted to understand why. but they were not the ones going about saying they have substandard PPE. That's actually not the fact. They're led by an amazing charge nurse, Anna, and she should be congratulated.
Well, thank you for that, and we'll ensure the minutes reflect those comments you've just made, because it does correct what is misinformation in the media at the moment. So thank you. If you're out there again, pass on our thanks personally to all of them, and you keep up the good work. So thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you.
Again, thought that was really, really useful to for the board to have the opportunity to, hear from the level of expertise that has been applied to all of the thinking and decisions and choices. Alan mentioned Anna. It's amazing the feedback from the families of Rosewood. They have been really clear about providing the right support and feedback to the staff about the amazing job that they're doing, looking after their loved ones. Further to that, there is significant planning underway for how we shift and change between alert levels. And again, as Alan touched on before, that includes both the public and private. It includes streaming, and includes quite different ways of delivering care. And there are quite detailed thinking and options and scenarios that have been worked through. And I'm not sure, Richard, whether you want to add anything further to that.
Hopefully people can hear me okay. I think it's very important that people don't think that moving between levels just allows an immediate resumption of pre-COVID business as usual. As long as we have COVID present in the New Zealand community, as in we're not a COVID-free country, we will have to maintain a high level of preparedness and sort of proactive strategies, including all the things you've heard about. This inevitably will lead to a significant degrading of our ability to deliver business as usual volumes. It's just not practical to keep teams separated, to stream patients, to maintain all the separations we've heard about, and have that same level as BAU. So I know Alan's referred to the work that's being done, which will get the most we can out of the system, but we have to not kind of worsen things by, in a precipitate way, trying to push through a lot of work in a way which actually generates a problem. So I just want to make sure that the board is very clear that we will do the absolute best that can be done, but we have to be realistic about what can be delivered in this new reality that we face.
The other element to that, I think, as staff and teams have got more comfortable with the use of PPE and different flows and streams, some of the anxiousness and fear and concern levels have also started to drop. And that's an important precursor to enable us to start shifting into different levels. So the amount of both input and support right across the organisation, the teams, has been really incredible in terms of being able to ensure that all the precursors are there to have clinical activity up and running as quickly as possible. Our biggest concern is still the level of deferred care. That is an area that is causing significant challenge, and you'll get a wee bit of a sense from the presentation later that Carolyn will take us through just where some of the clinical areas and types of services that are particularly concerning and worrying for us, and each and every one of those will have slightly different strategies. So just finally, hopefully the board getting the daily updates has been useful and helpful, keeping you abreast of both the emerging issues and challenges and actions and steps being taken. And again, just circulated last evening was, again, just a very summarised version from the incident controllers report to give a very simple and clear view of where we are as of last night, with a range of different activities. And again, summaries don't do a great deal of justice to the amount of effort that's gone into that. The other component too is the residential aged care sector remains an absolute area of focus. There's been a lot of comment made about Rosewood, and I think it's important to understand that once a virus gets into a very complex situation like that, and with very compromised individuals, it is important to be able to move really quickly to both protect and provide the right care and support in place. The virus is different from what a lot of aged care facilities would be used to handling. They're used to dealing with influenza. They're used to dealing with norovirus. But in fact, having staff stood down at very short notice and being able to separate patients is a unique circumstance. So it's really important in terms of contextually understanding that actually once you have a situation like this, the environment and response components for aged care are a lot more complicated and complex than what would be a normal situation. The aged care sector are very, very good at managing things such as norovirus and a number of other infectious diseases, and also speaks volumes for the few number of aged residential care facilities that have ended up with infections, and that reflects the significance and the importance of the shutdown measures that were put into place some time ago. But it does remain a real area of focus, and as Alan touched on before, we're doing everything possible, and New Zealand needs to do that, is to try and prevent spread of the virus within an aged care facility. But with that, really happy to take any queries or questions or comments. And as I said before, I'll touch on a wee bit later on just some of the other contextual issues that I think the board, very important for the board to understand.
Thanks, David. Ingrid?
No questions. Thanks, John.
Naomi?
Yes, I have a question around, I think I might have asked, this might have been asked in one of the subcommittee meetings about COVID, but I'm just wondering about I understand that we're way behind on the outpatients appointments related to the flooding of that building. I'm a bit concerned that if we are not, I know that we have to suspend those and I get that, but I'm concerned that in the lag of when the country's opened to starting those and just ongoing prolonging of not having, missing opportunities to, I don't know, or missing serious health issues that people may have that need to be addressed, I suppose, around the surgery as well. And just a bit concerned about, having those met in a timely fashion, given this 4-week break and then a backlog plus,
it is absolutely the right concern to have, and it's one of the things that has been foremost in our thinking. And I will give a bit of a surgical overview, and then I might get Carolyn to give a bit more of just some of the outpatient components. The surgical activity, we have all by every specialty has been stratified into urgent care, non-deferrable care that needs to be done within 2 weeks, deferrable care that needs to be done within 6 weeks, and then deferrable that is able to be pushed out for a period of time. So we have been doing a lot of operating over these last couple of weeks on the non-deferrable cases. In terms of those being brought forward, very much for the reasons you've outlined, is by not doing those treatments, the outcomes for a number of those individuals would be significantly worse. So that has been a really important part in terms of the risk stratification of every surgical specialty and discipline, and ensuring that all of the non-deferrable, and again, the urgent non-deferrable less than 2 weeks, then the less than 6 weeks. The challenge with that too is then twofold, is some of the deferrable work becomes non-deferrable the longer this goes on, and so that comes into the same to the same assessment. And then the other element is the referral rates or conversion rates from outpatient or GP referrals to surgery. There's a level of demand that's building up on that. So we're confident in the immediate period that the really urgent and non-deferrable work is happening through the surgical base. However, the longer this goes on, the more complex that comes, and that is where the work that is occurring with the private sector in terms of both COVID-free and COVID-infected facilities, how we cohort different groups of patients, is an important part of how we move into a different phase over this next week or two. We assess every day the status of the hospital in terms of the what measures we've got in place, and that's got a clinical review team that makes that assessment every day. So that's the surgical bit. In terms of outpatients, I'll pass an initial comment, and then Carolyn may want to add something more to this, is again, there's a range of non-deferrable outpatients that has been occurring as well. So there are particular care, things like Avastin with ophthalmology. You cannot stop doing the injection. So we have in fact been continuing to do that, and in a range of different settings to ensure that that care is happening. A lot of oncology, cancer treatments too, in an outpatient type setting have been occurring with, isolation or separation for a number of different patients and cohorts. There has also been a significant amount of virtual outpatients occurring. I think to date, around about 1,500 to 1,600 appointments have been done as virtual consults. There have also been a range of telephone connections with, deemed high-risk patients. And there's a considerable amount of work that is occurring between primary care and secondary care in terms of referrals, because the one element is once you start stop referrals from general practice left with an issue, what do we do with these individuals? So Carolyn might want to touch a wee bit on the work that is occurring in that space.
Thanks, David. So what we're doing is we're using our capability with our electronic request management system, and we've set up a dummy general practice in the middle so that we can get all of those referrals, and then with a combined team of both hospital-based clinicians and primary care-based clinicians, reprioritise so that we minimise the chance of dropping someone who actually urgently needed access or deteriorated. And we're working with the PHOs so that we can refer back to them the people who we're most concerned about, so they can keep a closer eye on them, actively reviewing them. Excuse me. We've already sent out to general practice a range of patients that we know are likely to be at risk and asked them to contact them and get and respond to them. At the moment, we've got roughly 10,000 people whose outpatient activity didn't happen that we stopped in the last couple of weeks. David's correct, about 1,600 of them have had a virtual. So we're working our way through reprioritising that list and prioritising it against the new list of the new people coming in. So all of that, we've restarted our referral process from primary care so that we can have a better view of what the priority is. We've raised this issue nationally, and there will be a steering group meeting, which I'm on, for the planned care steering group on Friday, where we're looking at maybe changing or providing new advice and changing some of the rules around waiting times, whether we reinstate active review, and so that we can better plan how we pick the system back up and do as little harm as possible going forward.
So just in addition to what Carolyn has done there, that plan care review team fits into the hospital-based framework, which both Michelle Arrowsmith and myself and Dale Olive from the YRAPA are the leads on that. And that will be involving a retweaking of the guidance and the advice going out to all district health boards with the resetting. So that provides a consistency of framework about decisions and choices. also advice around how facilities would operate in both the green, yellow, orange and red, because there will be part facilities that may be in red. And so Burwood is a case in point where we have a isolated, separated unit. That does not mean then the whole of Burwood is treated as, you know, kind of in the same context. So it's getting down to a much more nuanced set of advice and guidance that will, again, help and support the re-establishment of services both across the country and also here within Canterbury.
Yeah, I guess just further to comment on that, I suppose my concerns around that, especially around things that are maybe not not considered urgent, but then someone comes in and they actually find out from this outpatient's appointment, actually this person had a significant health issue, that if we didn't, that if waiting 4 weeks did create a negative outcome for that patient, for example, I suppose that's where my concerns lie. But I understand that there's a national framework around that.
So. Yeah, absolutely, Naomi, and that's why we've got a combination of general practice and specialists involved in the process to make sure that we minimise. I'm not saying we're going to miss them. I'm not saying we're going to get all of them, but we minimise the chance of that happening.
Thank you. Anything else, Naomi?
No, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Gabriel.
Nothing, thanks.
Thank you. Aaron?
Yeah, just one, David, around our hand hygiene audits. We've peaked at 83% in the past, 83%. Has that gone, given the COVID outbreak, has that gone to 100%? Just, I know it sounds silly, but I don't know, with the amount of advertising around how we couldn't be running at 100%. Or can you run it not 100?
I could almost confidently say that it is at least 100. But what is not occurring at the moment is the auditing of that, which is the reporting element that we've done in the same extent. But the focus on hand hygiene, and I think Alan touched on that is still one of the most important approaches and barriers to COVID-19. And the focus on hand hygiene has been right across, whether it be primary care, whether that be pharmacies, whether that be the aged care sector, the NGOs, and all of our own kind of provider operations. So I have absolutely no doubt that we're probably hitting 100%. Our challenge will continue to be continuing at that level as a business as usual type construct.
Thank you. Jamie?
No, nothing from me, thanks.
Thanks. Joe?
Nothing, thank you.
Andy?
No, thank you.
Catherine?
Nothing from me, thank you, John.
Barry?
Do you want to comment on heckling, please?
Yes, it is. We have been working very extensively with CPB, ministry, our maintenance and engineering and clinical teams to have the three ICU pods established and set up. And Mary may want to comment a wee bit further on this, but at this particular point, based on the update this morning, we're probably still a week away from those been ready. And Mary, you might want to comment on that.
Yes, thanks, David. We still have, there is at least another week's worth of work that CPB need to do before we could utilise them. And that is just mainly around some of the medical gas to the pendants in the ICU. They are doing some remedial pacifier defects had to be redone. They're doing those yesterday and today. They hope to have them finished by the end of play tomorrow. It will be at least another week.
And we can give a wee bit more detail, but later on as to what the extent of that work looks and feels like.
Thank you.
Lester?
Just a brief comment about what Alan had said, and then Richard also raised about how work will look in the future. I had a slight insight into this. I'm chairman of a company that operates in Australia, and it's in the engineering construction field, and we have had permission to operate under special circumstances, as many companies like ours do in Australia. And it is very different, you know. We're having to cohort our people. We've had to, we run laboratories there for testing. We've had to take additional space, which actually there's quite a lot of all of a sudden. And we've had to double our space so we could spread our people out. We have to have people go out in two cabs or two rigs because we can't have two people traveling out together. We're even cleaning our own facilities so we keep cleaners out of them. It's quite massive. And in Australia, they have got quite strict standards. And I expect that's what it'll look like for us a little bit. So one of the key things that I picked up from Richard, although he might want to clarify this, is that we should expect productivity to look different with the distancing, with the PPE on and off, with cohorting. And I was interested to see what Alan said about different shifts, different way of working. Yeah, I think it's going to be very significant, and I think that it's going to take a while to actually accommodate all of these different practices.
So just, Richard may want to comment, but spent a bit of time with Richard in Christchurch Hospital, I think about a week ago, just going through the whole PPE process within theatre. And you're absolutely right, Lester. And I think on average, for every operation of a COVID positive or suspect COVID case, adding somewhere between 3 to 3.5 hours per operation, just in terms of the processes and the changing and the prep work into PPE gear, the processes around the procedure, and then the recovery of the patient. And it really does hit home that actually our new future is going to be very, very different. And some of our workflows and processes are going to be very different and quite disrupted in many respects.
I think disruption is exactly the right word. It's the unpredictability, and patients, it's been reported in the media, but there are other examples where a patient quite innocently initially responds to questioning about their health status to make clear that they're not at risk. And they will then move through the health system and they start reflecting on what the questions they've been asked. And 3 or 4 hours in, or after they've had their operation, they say, you know, actually, I do know someone who is considered at risk. And it seems amazing that that would happen, but it's a real phenomena. And so you then immediately have to move to assessing all of the patients they've been in contact with. You have to slow down the process or shut down the theatre, isolate that area. And having the ability and the agility to do that inevitably has a production productivity consequences. So either you have to be very rigorous in trying to make sure that the patients are screened in that way, which of course we are, but inevitably people don't always respond accurately. I think we don't know what the future looks like yet, but I think it would be a reasonable expectation that our productivity will suffer through this. And Lester's giving excellent examples of you know, how that's functioning in his world.
Okay, thank you. David, thanks for the report, and to everyone for the answers. Justine, can we go on to your finance report, please?
Sure. So I'm happy to take the finance report as read. You'll note that the finance report talks to the February result, and obviously we do have the March result available at the moment as well. So the February result is in there, but maybe if I talk to the March result as a headline.
Thank you.
So our March operating result was, if you think about the two streams, there's the operating result and then there's the total result, including the indirect. Our operating result was an unfavourable variance of $340,000 compared to budget, and our total surplus deficit was a positive variance of $3.7 million to budget for the month. The thing to take into account is obviously we are counting the COVID costs as we go through, so predominantly those have been in the operating type costs as opposed to anything else. And COVID costs, as we've reported through to the ministry, which we do on a weekly basis, is totaling $829,000 for the month of March, which means that if you adjust out for the COVID-19 costs that are within that month, essentially you end up with a positive 489 operating result variance. And so that's just the difference. In terms of general trends, it's the same trends that we've seen before. There has been a slight ease up in the liquidity issues, where we can see that there was $10 million that was effectively provided to us in early April. Again, this is an advance on our June funding, but it will come back by way of deficit support in June. So those two will balance each other out, but that reduces some of that liquidity risk that we talk about in terms of the key financial risks there on page 2 of the finance report, whatever page it is. Other than that, yeah, it is very much the same as before. We have seen less pressure in terms of the industrial action, but obviously that is because some of the industrial action has been parked because of the COVID-19 issues. We are managing COVID-19 in terms of capturing all of the costs in using special flags and special codes. So our payroll costs have specially coded so that we can extract the COVID component out of the total payroll. And are doing the same thing with any capital costs and any other operating expenditure so that we can actually isolate and return COVID-only costs as opposed to the total. Those costs are remitted back to the centre on a weekly basis, so we send those back on 5 p.m. on a Tuesday. I'm happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you. Barry?
No questions for me.
Thank you. Catherine?
Sorry, can I unmute button? No questions from me, thank you.
Thank you. Andy?
No, thanks.
Joe?
I think my question might have to wait till the Hagley update, because I'm anticipating that if Hagley comes on stream early, there'll be some costs then attributed to the capital cost depreciation and where they sit. So I might wait till that one. I guess it's really hard to actually work out with this, but not a bad result given where we were, you know, what we were meant to be focusing on and what we've now have to focus on. I don't think we should discharge from the fact that we were set a task to keep in line with our budget, and despite the other pressures that were happening, that we have actually managed to do that. So, but I can actually hazard a guess that March, April, May are going to look entirely different.
Thank you. Jamie?
No, I'm good, thanks.
Thanks. Aaron?
Yeah, Justine, just around the COVID costs, are they the direct costs, or are we calculating at this point what the lag and other work and deferrals and stuff may cost as well?
No, so at the moment they are the direct costs rather than the projected outcome costs. And some of the projected outcome costs are a little fuzzy at this stage. So things such as, if we think about the electives, the entire country is in the same position in terms of electives being effectively ceased. And so one of the things that we are unsure of, and we're talking to the ministry as all CFOs are, around how the ministry is going to treat that in terms of the fragility of the electives revenue. Now, at this point, we haven't had any confirmation one way or another in terms of exactly how that's going to work. So our ability to quantify what that forecast impact on our electives revenue is reasonably difficult. We've got some areas where we know that there is definite impact. So we know that our cafe revenue, for instance, is affected by this, but we've also been able to affect some of the costs that go alongside that. But some of the more unknown ones will include, you know, what are the costs that we may have to external providers to enable them to continue, which may be in excess of what we would normally be contracting them to do. So some of those things aren't included in there. So we are very much at this stage recording the actual costs as opposed to the forecast costs.
Yeah, because as a city that's been through more than its fair share of disasters, we know that there's a whole lot of unintended consequences that sometimes take quite a while to surface. And I know you mentioned the cafe there. The other obvious one's going to be linen. Because with the hotel closures around the city for the foreseeable future, is going to have a massive impact on them as well.
Absolutely correct. So their commercial workers is significantly down. I think it's about 80% down compared to what they would normally be expected to see. Thankfully, it is at the tail end of the tourist season, but it is a very big impact for them, yeah.
Gabriel?
Just checking, have you had any update on the MOH $130 million equity funding?
So we've received the $10 million, which was in early April. Yeah. My understanding was that we were given advance notice of it. I haven't seen it come out officially with the minister's letter yet, but my understanding is that what has been either agreed or suggested, and there's no reason to assume that it's not. So, and the $10 million has come through as anticipated as well. But we haven't seen the formal letter yet, no.
Okay, thanks.
Naomi?
No questions from me, thank you.
Ingrid?
John, just one question in terms of Justine, just was looking for confirmation that there will be a national agreement in terms of how all of the costings, not just direct but indirect costings, are going to work for COVID. So I'm thinking as an example of something like annual leave that has, there was obviously an increased focus across our DHB, particularly on staff taking leave to make sure that our personnel costs were going to come in on budget. And that's obviously been severely disrupted as a result of COVID. So will there be some kind of national agreement so we're all treated in the same way about how some of those costs are going to be dealt with?
What am I just jump in there, Ingrid, just before Justine responds to that? And is there is work happening across all of the leave, electives, additional funding components for primary and community care that are all being done as a consistent national framework? I think it's fair to say that how that is going to be finally washed up and resolved as New Zealand Inc. is still being worked through. And will be a wee bit influenced by the change of alert levels over the next week or two, with the planning assumptions that go into place around the country. But all the DHBs are doing is providing input into those national processes so that the government can have a complete picture of the both likely production and delivery and where cost issues or challenges are likely to emerge. Sorry, Justine.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. The policy is being set at a national level. So things like the availability of special leave or the decisions around what kind of leave categories for different categories of staff, depending on if they're immunosuppression compromised. Those are all being done at a national level. The ability or the mechanism by which funding does or doesn't flow is really within the ministry's domain at the moment. You would expect fair treatment for all in terms of it will either be one way or another, but it may be a combination of some things are funded and other things are accepted deficit or accepted variation, if you know what I mean. So they may either fund it or they may just accept the variation from the DHBs on the basis that this was the national way. And there may be a mixture of those two things.
Okay, thanks.
Lester?
Oh, just a clarification, thanks, Justine. So when you report the Canterbury DHB group surplus or deficit, that is post-COVID costs?
So in the report in front of you, yeah. In the April board meeting, there is no COVID cost particularly in there. I mean, the rats and mice, absolutely, in the month of February. Yeah. In the month of March, what we will do is we will show the two so that you can sort of see if you normalise COVID out, what does that look like versus with COVID in there.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Justine. I think we now go to the paper and the recommendation that we go into public excluded. That's been circulated. Can I have a mover of that resolution, please?
I'll move, John.
Thank you, Ingrid. A seconder?
Yep, I'll second.
Thanks, Naomi. Is there any discussion? Is everybody in favour of that?
Aye.
All right, thank you. And we will now go to the PX agenda.